Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show.
It's a vital tool. It's an important tool. It's maybe the most important tool that they can think of. We're going to build the wall. We have no choice. We have no choice.
Why do we divide people? In this second part of our series, marking the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, we look beyond Germany to cities and countries still split by walls and barricades. From a 2,000-mile-long border in North America to Europe's last divided capital, we see if Berlin has taught us anything about the ways in which we keep some people in and others out. Plus, what would living in a walled-off London feel like? All that coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. We start today's episode in the United States. President Donald Trump talks of a new wall to fence off Mexico, America's southern neighbour. But there's one city in the country that already knows a thing or two about a life separated with a physical border. San Diego is home to three major points of entry for migrants crossing into the US from Mexico. Its proximity to the border has turned this sunny place into a thriving city where diversity is celebrated, embraced, or just simply part of the status quo. That is until you look at the existing 654 miles fenced off at the border, or to many of the border wall prototypes being erected on the orders of Mr. Trump. To understand how life unfolds in the shadow of a potentially bigger border wall, and what that means for the city, Monocle's acting bureau chief in Los Angeles, Carlotta Rebello, spoke to Sarah Libby, who is the managing editor of the Voice of San Diego newspaper. Let's listen in.
We do have a fence separating San Diego from Mexico. That's one of the things that's been kind of interesting to see this whole discussion play out, is talk about a wall when it's not an actual wall. It's more of a fence. And we're home to one of the biggest and busiest border crossings in the world. And so, you know, there's a lot of movement between San Diego and Tijuana. There are students who cross the border every day for school. There are workers who cross both ways to and from work. And so there's a lot of movement both ways. And that's something that we've always lived with. And we think it really contributes to, you know, the vibrancy of our city. And we've been opening up pedestrian walkways and bikeways and trying to expand access at the border to make it more efficient and to allow more people to cross. And so, you know, that in San Diego has been our priority, as opposed to, you know, building bigger barriers to stop that type of movement. San Diego has a Republican mayor, and he has said the city benefits from this border being open and accessible and us being allowed to trade and facilitate travel and tourism. And we think of it as a benefit to our city.
And it is in San Diego that one of these new border wall constructions that have been commissioned under President Trump are actually now being built, right?
Yeah, so we were home to some of the wall prototypes that the president and other people have come to tour, just little pieces of wall for people to look at. It seemed more like a publicity stunt than something useful. I think everyone knows what a wall looks like, but there is construction going on. But that being said, you know, we've had border barriers and fencing and three layers of fencing across the border for years. And so it's something that we're pretty used to.
I'm curious, and I guess the way you've been describing things, it seems very much like San Diego benefits from this movement of people that work or live in either side of the border. So I guess how effective is it in the end? Because its goal is to stop people from crossing. Is there a purpose for its existence?
Well, I mean, certainly we want people to cross legally through the border crossing in which they're, you know, vetted by immigration officials and things like that. And so I understand why, you know, they want a barrier to deter illegal crossings. But because of the rhetoric and, you know, this wall structure, it seems like they're trying to deter all types of movement. And we think as long as it's happening legally and safely at the actual border crossing, that we as a city really benefit from it.
Do you think there will be a time that we'll see that wall come down, or is it still a future that is too far off?
I don't know that it would ever be taken down entirely. Like I said, we've had some sort of fence system and structure in place for several years, and that's been pretty uncontroversial. So I don't see it coming down anytime soon, but we're just still hoping to expand access to legal crossings and build more ways for people to get to and from Mexico.
Sarah Libby there, speaking with Carlota Rebello in Los Angeles. Often described as Europe's last divided capital, Nicosia on the island of Cyprus is split between the Turkish-administered north and the Greek Cypriot south. The United Nations buffer zone extends beyond the city boundaries to cut the entire country east to west and was set up after intercommunal violence. Monocle's Daphne Karnizis visited the city and brings us this report.
If you're ever in Nicosia, Cyprus's capital city, try walking north on the bustling shopping thoroughfare of Ledra Street and you'll come across an obstacle. The street abruptly ends at an unmistakable dead end with cement bunkers, barricades of stacked oil barrels and barbed wire fencing. This so-called Green Line, named so after a British Army general drew it on the map in 1964 using a green pencil, now runs across the entire width of the country, splitting it into north, the Turkish side, or conquered lands, as Greek Cypriots call it, and the south side, where Greek Cypriots reside. A UN-controlled buffer zone of no more than a few metres splits the two sides of the capital, which is Europe's last divided one. Locals call this the dead zone. While crossing the two sides of the city was once forbidden, until 2003, now it's a different story. If you bring your passport to one of the several pedestrian checkpoints across the line, you won't have trouble passing through. They're open 24 hours a day, and there are no restrictions on the number of times you can cross. A word of caution, you won't be let back into the Greek-speaking side if you don't have an EU passport. On a sticky September afternoon, while visiting South Cyprus for a friend's wedding, I decided to take the trip across to the Turkish side for the first time. Walking along Ledra Street, with no real warning, the scene of cafes and shops suddenly gives way to what looks like a shabby, almost makeshift checkpoint hut, where a single soldier in uniform smokes lazily, scrolling through his iPhone. For him, it's business as usual. I later find out that this is the main crossing, which opened in 2008. I steal a glimpse at the sudden expanse of green behind him, the unmistakable overgrowth of the trees in the UN's no man's land. Rare pockets of green in the city that, cruelly, no one can enjoy. Greek Cypriot officers check and scan your passport on one side, Turkish officers check your passport on the other. Before even stepping foot on the other side, I can already sense a change in atmosphere, crossing from a European capital, the officers with their computer screens and scanning machines, to a more laid-back stance on the other, officers smoking, playing backgammon, and drinking coffee while sitting outside their checkpoint kiosk. Subtle differences that already suggest a change of setting. Now in North Nicosia, I take a stroll amidst the main bazaar, the Bandabulya Municipal Market, the Selimi Kami Mosque, and the Buyuk Han, built in 1572 by the first Ottoman governor of Cyprus. Casual crossings may have gotten easier, but wounds are still fresh for Greek Cypriots, and there are still constant reminders of the division. Like the Turkish flag that's been painted high up on the mountains on the Turkish side, visible by everyone on the southern side as they go about their daily routines. A strong display of nationalism that's even lit up at night. Or the minarets and the calls to prayer that can be heard when one walks close to the Green Line. Lingering from the days pre-2000s when crossings were forbidden, there's still a bitterness and an insecurity about getting too close to the other side. But the once deserted old town of Nicosia, full of neoclassical mansions and winding streets, is slowly being noticed again by its residents for the first time in decades. The low prices and plentitude of old buildings are luring in a new generation of young creatives. Once abandoned buildings have been turned into graphic design and architecture studios, or workshops for carpenters and weavers, like the architecture studio of Kostas Nofertidis, barely a few metres from the Green Line. The regeneration also comes with the help of foreign creatives. UK-based architects Field and Clegg Bradley are behind the much-loved Leventis Art Gallery near the historic part of town. Loosened crossing restrictions have given people, particularly younger creatives, a renewed sense of security and freedom. There are even plans to create an annual festival on the division. people are no longer shying away from making use of the city's beautiful old town, even if it's a little closer to the other side than they'd like. For Monocle, in Nicosia, I'm Daphne Karnesis.
Just across the water from Cyprus is one of the world's most recognisable divides. The West Bank barrier separating Israel from Palestine traces the so-called Green Line between the two territories. While Israelis see it as a purely defensive measure, many Palestinians believe its purpose is to take their land and liberty. We spoke with Dr. Atef Al-Sha'ir, a Palestinian author and lecturer who attended Birzeit University in the West Bank. Let's hear him talking about living with the barrier.
In many ways, if you cut off communities from each other, what you notice with time, and that's the experience of Gazans, for example, because they're also a community that is very much hemmed in, it basically creates a kind of some sort of a siege mentality, because this is the only experience you've got. In the West Bank, it creates social fractures, political fractures. Also, it impedes everyday life. So students who want to go to school, they are forced to go through sometimes some barriers. Sometimes they're not allowed. Shepherds, farmers, etc. So there is severe mental and psychological and emotional impact in the sense that it actually keeps you within a very little territory, unable to travel, unable to do much. And that certainly creates resentment, it creates all kind of psychological impacts, and also the potential to do harm to others, because that's the only way you could perhaps resist this kind of force. People who are hemmed in, as you described, will always try to find a way of infiltrating, because they are desperate, because their conditions are desperate. So they actually are used by politicians to manipulate the population, to give them the sense of security sometime, or to use the veneer of security, as in the case of Israel and other countries, I'm sure. But actually what they do, the people who want to resist the subjugation or the desperate conditions where they find themselves, will find other ways.
Now tell me, you know, even as we said, naming this barrier has been contentious in the past, and its aims and ambitions are disputed on both sides. But for Palestinians, who people saw what was happening in Israel, a large number of suicide bombings and a period during the Second Intifada when many people were being killed on buses, the Israeli response to building a barrier, it couldn't have come as a dramatic surprise, because it had been discussed for many, many years, this idea of separating the peoples. Did Palestinians think there was an alternative to a physical barrier like this to allow people on both sides to live in security?
The claim of security, obviously security is a genuine matter for everybody, for every community, every nation, that is true. But the point about that, actually, to prevent that, it's about creating a political climate where there is peace. And Israel has not done that in the past. And I think that's the feeling among the Palestinians, that basically the barrier didn't stop, as it were, suicide bombing. What stopped it was another political reality that has been created after 2006, when the Intifada kind of died down. Those who want to do this sort of thing, they could unfortunately still do it. The separation wall, it might limit it to some extent, but it doesn't completely stop it. So actually this barrier is just Israelis make a claim about it. The Israeli government make claims about security, and that is the catchphrase for Israel. But the reality of it is that it's a barrier that is basically meant to cement Israeli expansionist policies in the West Bank. So for the Palestinians, these are the underpinnings, the underlying reasons as for why the barrier is constructed. But the reality is completely different, with all the kind of negative effects that it has on them.
When you think of historical examples like the Berlin Wall, for that tiny wall in a way to come down in Berlin, evolved because there were dramatic changes in the politics on both sides and a realignment of a world order. Do you think that in the end, for the wall, the barrier to come down between Palestinians and Israelis would involve something as dramatic as that, a kind of a realignment of the world order? Do you see any hope of it coming down?
It's very hard to speak about hope when the situation is so gloomy. But I think there must be hope. There must be a way out of this situation. And that way would have to be for this barrier to come down. So naturally, I'm an optimistic person. I'm a hopeful person. I think most Palestinians are, because it's very much an anomaly. It's anachronistic. It's not something that is natural. It's not something permanent that you can live with forever, you know, across all generations, all times. So I hope that this is a temporary, and there will be that a dramatic moment when it comes down. And there have been already all sorts of demonstrations around the barrier when one fell, or at least just one section of it fell. It's just a symbol that this is cannot stand there forever, and there may be, you know, people change and governments change and things change. Obviously, this is a very long-term conflict and it has cost a lot, but the long-term hope and vision that it would come down, because it doesn't serve anyone.
Dr. Atef Al-Shea, thank you so much for joining us here on The Urbanist. Closer to home, the UK has its own version of religious and nationalist-based division, Northern Ireland. Rooted in political and sectarian disputes between Catholics and Protestants, things turned violent in the 1960s, and in response to rioting in 1969, peace lines were constructed between the communities. The Good Friday Agreement of 1998 sought to bring peace to such segregated communities, but 50 years after the barriers went up, the divides have only grown wider in many cases, and violence is still present to this very day. And with Brexit now further complicating the issue, what's next for the peace lines? Peter Osborne is a director at the Integrated Education Fund in Northern Ireland and joins me on the line from Belfast, along with Dennis Murray, the former BBC Ireland correspondent. Dennis, if I could start with you, how has the Brexit process affected the divisions already at play in Northern Ireland?
Brexit has been a complete disaster for Northern Ireland. Nobody talked about a united Ireland apart from Sinn Féin until Brexit. Next domino to fall, the DUP espoused Brexit with open arms when other unionists said this is very dangerous, which has made Brexit something that is meant to be a Protestant stroke unionist issue. Now, it might have crossed those lines, except that the trouble is things here are always inclined to revert to those lines. But look at the way in Britain itself, the people who by the end of the process were saying no deal, the same people were saying before the referendum, well, a second referendum might be necessary. And of course, we want to stay in the single market. We want a wonderful deal with the European Union. Just in the way with British politics, it has become an enormously divisive issue. Now, this place was divided enough already. But here's the difficulty. The Good Friday Agreement, in fact, any future for Northern Ireland, was predicated on the fact that both the UK and Ireland would be in the European Union, because that means there's no visible sign that the two bits of Ireland are different. The fear is that it's going to bring those hard borders back and those barriers back.
Well, let's bring you in here, Peter. Those hard borders, those barriers, they are existing. Do you feel a sense of being in some way in a city that is fortified and divided? Because they don't get talked about in the way that a Berlin Wall would or the barrier in Israel would. Somehow they have been in the background a little bit.
They are in the background, but they're very much in the forefront of people's minds, I suspect, in Belfast, and especially those people who live close to the interface barriers, the peace walls. And don't forget that when the troubles were occurring through the 70s and 80s, a very high percentage, I mean, nearly 50% of people who got killed during the troubles were killed within a few hundred yards of interface communities. So these working class communities have suffered during the conflict, and they're now suffering as well because of what is now for them probably a new normal of having these peace walls in their vicinity. I'd go back to when they were built. I mean, they were built in 70, 71, 72. A committee led by the then Home Secretary in Northern Ireland, John Taylor, considered whether to put the peace walls up. And there were basic considerations about it's better that either side of the community fight the British Army than they fight each other. And that's part of the reason why they went up. And they took a decision to construct them. But there was one person not in the room. It was an English advisor. And the English advisor wrote a minority report in that said, if you put these peace walls up now, you will not be able to take them down for at least 100 years. And 50 years on, it's hard to disagree with that English advisor, because the 2023 target is not going to be met. And part of the reason why it's not going to be met is you can't set a target and then not genuinely commit politically in government with resource to take the interface barriers or the peace walls down. And I think that goes to the heart of a key issue for Belfast and Northern Ireland as a whole, is that 21 years after the Good Friday Agreement, and I was in the room when the Good Friday Agreement was concluded, and the sort of hope and aspiration we had at that time hasn't been fulfilled. But you can't do that. You can't end the segregation, end the divisions, take down interface barriers without proper resourcing and proper commitment from government. Now, when you look at how divided Belfast is, in 1998, when the agreement was signed, 93% of social housing in Belfast was segregated, 90% plus of those areas being one side of the community or another. 21 years on, guess what the percentage is? 93% of social housing in Belfast is still segregated. When you look at education, these are the two critical issues, housing and education. Currently, 93% of children in Northern Ireland go to schools that are segregated. So you've got to break down these divisions to actually get underneath and end the segregation. Now, until we do that, we are going to continue to perpetuate the segregation in this society, which means that whenever we get into some difficulty as we are now, this society could go backwards, not just go forwards. There is no inevitable forward flow to this peace process. It can go backwards. So at some point, we have to take those critical decisions around housing and education.
Do you share the same concern over what Brexit will do, that it will just entrench attitudes even more?
I do. And if you look at what it seems to me is happening in England, it seems to have entrenched opinion and divisions. In the times that I've been across to England, it's almost like politics and religion in Northern Ireland. In polite company, you don't talk about Brexit because it is entrenched opinion over there. Well, if that's what's happening in England, what on earth is happening in Northern Ireland, where I suspect there is even greater currency to what Brexit might be and the consequence of it for the border and for the constitution and future of Northern Ireland? So, as Dennis says, it has become an issue that is synonymous with the political and religious division here. I think that's extremely unfortunate. But then again, I think it's very unfortunate that the UK as a whole has decided on this course of action, because I really can't see the benefit of Brexit anyway.
Well, perhaps, Dennis, we could finally return to you. We've seen some of the ideas there that, you know, could potentially begin to bring communities together, education, working with younger generations. What do you think action could be taken to try and keep the discussion open and to get, you know, activities across the borders between these two communities?
The one thing I think is crucial, and the one thing I think no British central government will attempt, is integrating education. Now, I went on the air 20 or 30 years ago as a young reporter. I covered the start of Lagan College in Belfast, which was the first attempt at an integrated school, and it's still there and it's thriving. Now, where there are integrated schools, they do very well. But I used to quote the old Gilbert and Sullivan thing, every little child that's born alive will be a little liberal or a little conservative. But where you go to school isn't going to change your opinions if you're going back behind the walls again. I have now changed that opinion, and I have come to take the opposite view of that. If you don't have integrated education, you are never going to resolve this place. Never.
Dennis Murray and Peter Osborne there. Thank you very much for joining me. Speaking of Brexit, have you ever wondered what might happen if London declared independence from the UK and remained in the European Union? Would that potentially begin the capital's own story as a fortified city? Well, we convinced Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Mueller, to look into his crystal ball to find out.
The Conservative and Unionist Party, its full official name used to be. The train of events it set in motion with David Cameron's ill-advised European Union referendum in 2016, 20 years ago now, led to the and unionist part being quietly dropped just after Scotland's second independence referendum in 2021. after which the newly sovereign state north of Hadrian's Wall applied successfully for readmission to the EU. Northern Ireland, which never quite left the EU, even when the United Kingdom finally did in December 2020, resumed full membership in 2023 as six counties of a reunified Republic of Ireland. Shortly after that, Wales, which had voted leave in 2016, changed its mind about Brexit and about Britain and declared independence itself. In 2016, London had voted resoundingly Remain. Once Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales had decided they were better off without England, London's own independence movement rapidly acquired an irresistible critical mass, especially as the costs and chaos imposed by Brexit became more and more onerous. The reduced England sulked as its former fellow constituents of the UK boomed and was mired in an incessant rancour that necessitated four more general elections in the early years of the 2020s. The 2024 vote was the final straw for Londoners. It was won by the new English Conservatives movement, a hard right sect now led by former Dollar and Bucks Fizz singer David Van Day, who had become a Tory councillor in Thurrock in 2019 and ascended stealthily since. The ECM defeated a Labour Party still led by Jeremy Corbyn, despite five previous election losses, under the slogan, "The real fight starts now." A referendum on London becoming a sovereign entity in 2026 was carried by an even greater margin than the EU referendum a decade previously. Elections were swiftly called, after which Prime Minister Sadiq Khan formally declared independence and applied also successfully to join the EU. It became swiftly clear that while London possessed many of the accoutrements of a nation-state, a hefty economy, a bigger population than many members of the EU, a coherent regional identity, it would need to make one key and ironic compromise with itself. One of the world's great open cities was compelled, in the interests of maintaining what was now one of the EU's external borders, to build a wall. The M25, the ring road laid around London between 1975 and 1986, proved an obvious foundation for what became known as the New London Wall, in deference to the smaller fortification erected by the Romans some while earlier. The New London Wall was, of course, controversial. There was some lobbying for a corridor to Brighton, and a great deal of enthusiasm for deviating the New London Wall sufficiently from the M25 to exclude Croydon. However, England agreed to drop all its other claims for compensation if London agreed to keep it. In London behind the wall, not a great deal changed. Both Londoners and non-Londoners would have willingly confirmed, if for vastly different reasons, that London had long since detached itself spiritually from the rest of England, a city far more in touch with the rest of the world than with the country it served as a capital. Heathrow and city airports stayed open. The banks of the City of London resumed their pre-Brexit roaring trade, welcoming a few grateful exiles back from Frankfurt and Paris. London's culture thrived in its odd new circumstances, much as West Berlin once had when isolated from a hostile East Germany. The only major adjustment was the relocation of England's Parliament from the Palace of Westminster on the banks of the Thames to Birmingham, then Manchester, then Leeds, all of which it was obliged to flee as the Midlands, Lancashire and Yorkshire serially seceded. Its beleaguered members eventually sought asylum on the Isle of Wight, whose only noteworthy resident, Mark King, out of Big in the 80s slap-bass weirdos Level 42, had seized power in 2025. On the New London Wall, the checkpoints were actually notably quiet. As previously, few Londoners took much interest in England, and vice versa. The wall ended up representing a division, more than creating one.
Andrew Mueller there, musing over a fortified London. And be sure to listen to this week's episode of The Foreign Desk, as Andrew and his guests look at some of the underlying politics that caused the cracks in the Berlin Wall to form. That's available now at monocle.com. Well, that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced by David Stevens and Carlotta Ribello, and David also edited the show. What a clever chap he is. Well, we're going to play you out this week with a track that was remixed to serve as lobby music for the Walled Off Hotel, an immersive art experience created by the street artist Banksy, located near the West Bank barrier. Well, here's Tom Waits with Innocent When You Dream. Thank you for listening, city lovers. And it's such a sad old feeling. All the fields are sorry.